and the case will be taken under advisement. Thank you. And we will go on to appeal number 023663, which is the United States versus Bobby D. Jones. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Larry Fleming, and I'm an assistant federal public defender in Southern Illinois. And I am arguing a case today that was not my case in the trial court, nor did I write the brief. But it gave me
That's a disclaimer if ever I heard one.
People say, why? It gave me a free trip to beautiful, balmy Chicago. So here I am.
We even had the sun out for you briefly for about 20 minutes.
Thank you. We have here a case involving Bobby Dwayne Johnson and Dede Dubereaux, my opponent in this case, noted to me this morning, today's his birthday. He is now 31 years old today. Bobby Johnson's criminal history category consists of one prior drug conviction some 10 years ago in 1992. He did have an assault thereafter, assault and trespassing in 2000. One prior drug conviction. He is looking at, he is now serving a sentence of 210 months. He is serving a sentence of 90 months more than he would have been serving based upon the amount of crack cocaine with which he was caught. That 90 months that he is serving is based solely upon the last seven lines of a statement which was written for him by the police and which is enclosed as an exhibit to the government's brief, which is attached as an appendix, in which Bobby Johnson apparently signed this statement written for him, which says, I've been selling crack cocaine for about 7 or 8 months. I sell about 1 ounce a day to regular customers. I have more than 100 regular customers. My source is in North St. Louis. I don't sell heroin. I use it myself. These seven lines is the only evidence the government has to increase his sentence 90 months from where it would be otherwise. And this points out a problem which is systemic and becoming worse, and that is a person is arrested for a relatively small amount of drugs. They are then interviewed by the police, and for whatever reason, they believe they are helping themselves by being totally candid or maybe even exaggerating, and they walk themselves into a sentence far beyond that which they would have otherwise.
Pause. You have my sympathy with your position, but there was a credibility finding by the court that this was appropriate and he was telling the truth.
And I'm saying that credibility finding was clearly erroneous based on the circumstances of this case.
But is there any evidence that he was led to believe that he could get out of custody if he exaggerated his past drug dealing?
No, there was not, and I'll tell you why there was not, and that is because he didn't testify, and he couldn't testify. The reason he couldn't testify is he ran a risk. If he were to have testified, and this is the risk this is the box that is put, that defendants, at least in our district, are put in constantly. He ran the risk of having his acceptance taken away from him, three levels there, of having obstruction by reason of perjury laid on him. So he risked five levels.
Or indicted for perjury if the
right. If he opens his mouth and the judge doesn't believe him.
But that's true every place.
But in this particular case, we have a situation where the 10 grams of crack that he was found with was increased to 6 kilograms.
You understand, I do not particularly have any sympathy for the sentencing guidelines, so you've got my what I get hung up on is how we overrule a credibility finding which has predicate in the actual situation.
You do so by looking at the circumstances of this case where the police interviewed a person who was admittedly withdrawing from, who was going through withdrawal symptoms.
So we restrict our finding only if somebody is interviewing somebody who is going through withdrawal and is happy enough to think that if he exaggerates his guilt, that it will have benefited somehow. That's how we draw it.
Savvy enough. He's stupid enough to believe that. But in this situation...
I said sappy.
No, sappy. I'm sorry. I thought you said
savvy. Not sappy. No. I was sappy.
That's his big problem. He wasn't sappy.
Yeah. Well, we have a situation here where he admittedly, or the government admits, he's at least going through the initial stages of heroin withdrawal. Under any other circumstances, we would say this person can't. This is not credible evidence. If you look at the
we wouldn't say. You mean somebody who is the finder of fact could say or not say, and that we'd have a hard time going against that one too.
Well, finders of fact, I think, often make mistakes, and in this situation,
well, finders of law do too. But otherwise, we wouldn't even bother being here.
The real question here is: can you increase somebody's sentence 90 months? Based upon a statement that was taken when he was admittedly withdrawing from the effects of heroin.
The simple answer is yes, but go ahead.
Okay. But if you just read the testimony of the assistant U.S. attorney, assistant federal public defender who first interviewed him, now this is 36 hours afterwards, and it was about 20 hours after the statement was taken, but she says, I thought he was mentally ill or epileptic. He could not answer my questions. He was clutching and having spasms. He was rolling on the floor. His teeth were gritted like a picture from the starvation camp, just gritted so hard. She goes on and on describing the condition that this man is in.
Right, and the problem is that's not when the police officers took the statement.
Well,
you know, the statement was taken within a very short time. You know, you have the problem of the officers didn't observe anything unusual.
Well, the officers who interviewed him did say that they knew that he was a heroin addict, and
they knew it, and he had been crying.
And I think that
was it, though, in terms of his physical demeanor, in terms of any signal to them that he was going through withdrawal.
And one officer said he did say he had a large heroin habit, both the night before when I arrested him and during the interview. I've had some experience, so I expected that he would become sick. The officer said he knew that he was
becoming... He's on a withdrawal. If you've ever seen anybody cold turkey on the floor of a jail, it's something to watch. My earlier experiences was a prosecutor in a county nearby, and I watched it happen on several, and it is a devastating thing, but it occurs after he's been off the stuff for a while. DTs occur after you quit drinking.
Well, keep in mind, this interview occurred 11 hours after he was arrested, so he had been off of it for at least 11 hours.
You can go 11 hours. Sometimes you can go 24, 36, but pretty soon it's going to catch you.
Dr. Lippman, the neuropharmacologist, testified that these withdrawal symptoms start about 8 hours after the last use. We also have an inherent improbability in this statement. Here's a guy who says he has 100 regular customers. He's dealing an ounce of crack cocaine a day, and that would be about over $1,000 a day in profit, because the cop said he's buying it for $900 and selling it for $2,200 or $2,500. Here's a man who's making $1,000 a day for 7 months, and he drives his girlfriend's car to this particular buy.
Yeah, but we of the real world know that there are a lot of these people with heroin habits that almost reach 1,000 a day.
This guy, 2 gram habit would probably take $200 a day. And I acknowledge that. It's about $100 a gram for heroin. We have a situation here where to base 90 months on a statement taken under these circumstances without any corroboration. Now, the police officers say they didn't even corroborate with the individual to whom he sold at that time about how many times previously. They didn't go out and check. And one of the police officers, the Collinsville police officer, says, I didn't do it because it wasn't my job. I'm a Collinsville police officer, so I'm not gonna follow up. Certainly we need something more than 7 lines in a handwritten statement written by the police when this guy is suffering.
Look, the terrible problem here, Mr. Fleming, is that carried to its extreme, this argument would require that we disbelieve statements by any drug user because the fear of experiencing withdrawal could cause them to lie in the hopes of getting out and getting a drug fix.
And
this is terrible.
Well, and specifically defendants. Because if this was, if we were talking about a third party who made this statement, you know, the fact that they should go and they should find out that this really happened and let's get some corroboration, but it being the defendant, it just...
It's my position that if you're going to lay 90 additional months on somebody, you really ought to get some corroboration of the statement that they've made, at least following up with the one individual they know he was attempting to sell to, but they didn't even do that. I would like to reserve a little bit of time. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel.
Carol Burrow.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello.
Good morning. Or good afternoon, I might.
Just barely. Go ahead.
As the court has pointed out, the appellant is in a very difficult situation here into trying to overcome the clearly erroneous standard here. And since the fact finder was the judge, clearly his credibility determinations are given exceptional deference. And what the court found was that the statement was reliable. The court found this based upon three factors. The officer's testimony, who testified as to their observations when the defendant was interviewed, that he exhibited no signs of heroin withdrawal, that they are both familiar with heroin use and heroin withdrawal, that they specifically asked the defendant, was he experiencing any type of sickness, and all the defendant stated was that he was slightly nauseous. They specifically asked him if he was dope sick, and the defendant specifically denied that he was not dope sick.
He denied that he was dope sick.
He said he was not dope sick at that time.
You just used a double negative in your sentence ahead of time and got me all moved up. But go ahead.
Thank you for correcting me. The court was correct in that the statement was only approximately 11 hours after the arrest, and additionally, the court relied upon the expert testimony of the defendants, Dr. Lippman, but the court relied upon that testimony for the fact that only the progression of the withdrawal from heroin. And the court found that based upon the expert testimony explaining the progression of heroin, along with the officer's testimony, who he found to be very credible and helpful, he determined that during the time that statement was taken, he was not experiencing any of the signs of heroin withdrawal, and therefore the statement was in fact reliable. The court also looked at the statement itself, and the court made some interesting comments regarding the statement itself, in that the defendant admitted to selling about an ounce a day in his statement. Approximately about a half of an ounce was found on the defendant when arrested. The court also can tell from the PSR regarding the individual that was at the hotel room, Mr. Robert Oulette, I believe it is, where he stated that that he had bought from him several 16ths, that any time he'd call the defendant, he would come, and he would generally have about an ounce of crack on him. So based upon all of these factors, the court was able to make credibility determinations and determine that during this time, the statement was in fact voluntary, and the statement was in fact credible. In fact, the court found that it believed that it could find this even beyond a reasonable doubt, and it only needed to find beyond a preponderance of the evidence. So based upon these factors, and albeit it may be very unfortunate that this individual has a prior drug conviction and was enhanced pursuant to 21 U.S.C. 851 and therefore would have received a minimum mandatory 120 months due to his criminal history, along with this statement, is what resulted in the additional 90 months imprisonment that the appellant objects to.
Of course, at the time for the pre-sentencing report, you obviously tendered his statement as the government, and the probation officer found that this amount should be attributable to him, and then his counsel filed an objection. I mean, given that this was 120 mandatory minimum anyway, the government could have chosen not to oppose their motion.
Clearly there could have been decisions made.
Right.
I was not the trial counsel.
I understand. And like you acknowledge that this is unfortunate that he goes from 120 to 210, but this was a decision you know, the government made the decision not to oppose him. So I understand, I appreciate the arguments that counsel is making. I don't think his arguments are going to carry the day, but let's not forget here that at least a part of this mix as to why we're here is because the government, you know, objected.
Your Honor, the defendant was not only given notice prior to the, he was given notice at the time before the change of plea and acknowledged at the change of plea that his post-arrest statement, if accepted by the court, would result in additional time. The defendant could have taken other measures such as filed a motion to suppress that statement or could have taken this to trial and could have tried to avoided the additional relevant conduct. Perhaps the defendant could have also taken the position at sentencing of testifying so that the court could have judged his credibility and made a determination based upon that.
And he could have gotten 300 months.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact of the matter is the government knew he was a junkie and that he experienced withdrawal, and I understand it was several hours later when he was really in the full withdrawal. I just don't want us to forget here that there are choices that can be made, and there are choices that can be made by the prosecutor. This court doesn't have that kind of discretion, but certainly your office does.
I certainly recognize that, Your Honor, and certainly that something could have been done as to waiving appeal if the government had not opposed that motion, and certainly there probably could have been negotiations that would have resulted in less work for myself, for counsel, as well as for the court.
It's not an issue of work for the court. It's the number of years for the defendant that concerns all of us, I think it's fair to say.
Your Honor, it was, in fact, based upon his statement. It wasn't based upon hearsay statements of other witnesses.
She didn't say,
he
broke the law.
Right.
She's talking about the discretion of court of the prosecution occasionally gives one pause. I mean, and I exercised that very many years when I was a prosecutor, and I know what the issue is. But it's not a complaint level against you. It's a complaint level against the prosecution in general.
I understand that argument.
You've already won, so I don't know why.
I was just going to say, based upon this, we'd ask that you simply affirm the sentence of the district court. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the secret of a good lawyer is to look good losing, and you're a good lawyer.
Sure.
I will say this. Ms. Durbero is one of the kindest prosecutors in that office, and I really feel bad that she's here taking the heat for policies which she has no control. I would also point out, however, that it's recently been reported in the Post-Dispatch, consistent with Sentencing Commission reports, that the Southern District of Illinois has the highest average.
We're very aware.
Right.
Of any district in the country.
Right. In the country.
And I think that's something that has to be addressed somewhere.
Well, that's what the guidelines were supposed to do, right? Make sure there was equity in sentencing.
Yeah. And this is 3 years running, so I don't know.
Well, that makes us even more pleased that it's you that's here, Ms. Dubero. Since if Mr. Fleming says you're one of the kindest people in that office, we take that at face value. All right. Okay. We're going to take the case under advisement. We thank you both. Have a good trip back. And the court is in recess until tomorrow.
Well, that's sunshine for you.
Thank you, Your Honor.